Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast, Jamie and John here to bring you another case. What's up, John?
Dude, I don't know. Just kind of crazy. Life is crazy.
Life is crazy. And I'm going to be honest with you. Things are going to get a little bit crazy today, I'm afraid. I have been down so many rabbit holes on this assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. And last week we shared the details of the crime, the things that we know, and the arrest that happened of James Earl Ray. But today we're going to dive more into theories of why it may have happened and maybe some alternate theories. But before we do, John, I saw we have some people to thank.
Yeah, I want to thank Kate over on Patreon, who started her Patreon binge listening today, like right before we were recording. So thank you, Kate.
We really appreciate that. Also got a couple of 5-star reviews that I'd like to give a shout out to. This is from Millie Bolding. It simply says, love you guys. And this one says, True Crime Caster. Well, maybe they just created an account to give us a review. Thanks for that. The storytelling, the discussions, the banter all make for interesting podcasts. My favorite from day one. So thank you, True Crime Caster. Go out and give us some other reviews as well. So please do that. That's the best way to help the show, best way to get us some requests for cases to be covered and to give us your feedback on what we're saying. So a lot of thank yous, but we have a lot of content to get to today, John. Like I said, I've been down some rabbit holes, and I like to think that you and I are logical. We're not conspiracy theorists. We don't have crazy ideas. We'll see if we still think that at the end of today's episode.
Yeah, we'll see. So I'm excited to get into it. And I know you were excited to talk to me a little bit about my feelings because you've been like deep into research. I feel like I'm only scratched the surface compared to what you've done. So why don't you get the ball rolling?
Yeah, there's a lot going on here. So the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. was an event that really put the entire nation into grief. And in some ways, it was a little bit of a flashback to when JFK was killed, in that it was an assassination of a public figure. But there was a lot of doubt that came with this. I know we speculate all the time on Harvey Oswald and JFK's killing, but I don't think we speculate as much about King's death, but those theories are out there. Thinking about how somebody as important as MLK could be killed by somebody like James Earl Ray, which is very much just an everyman. He was a petty thief. He was caught fairly quickly after this. He pled guilty, and then for most of the public story, he just kind of faded into obscurity. But that may not be exactly what happened. It's been over 50 years since Martin Luther King Jr. was killed. The amount of conspiracy and strange occurrences warranted an investigation in the 90s, and I think that discussion needs to continue today. Like we mentioned at the end of last week's episode, the King family seems to believe that there's more to this story. His wife, Coretta Scott King, and all of his kids, especially Dexter is the main one leading the charge here, say they don't believe that James Earl Ray was the only culprit, and some of them don't believe that he had anything to do with it.
Let's do a little recap of what we discussed last week. But if you haven't listened, I would just hit pause right now, go back to last week's episode and give it a listen. But on April 4th, 1968, in Memphis, Tennessee, while King was working to support a strike that was for some black sanitation workers, he was assassinated on the balcony outside room 306 of the Lorraine Motel. The day after giving his final speech, that he, I've been on a mountaintop, or I've been to the mountaintop speech. After 2 months of searching, authorities finally had their main suspect. And as you mentioned, that was James Earl Ray and he was hiding out in London, or was going to try to hide out. He was at the airport there in Heathrow, London. All fingerprints at the scene on the weapon led back to the escaped convict. and a confession only dug Ray's grave deeper. On March 10th, 1969, he received a 99-year sentence without a trial. He pled guilty. And he, you know, with his guilty plea, it likely saved him from the death penalty. Back then, they were very much doing the death penalty, and his plea deal probably saved his life.
And you mentioned a confession. He did plead guilty, but whether or not he ever confessed and said, "I did this," is still up for debate, because in his guilty plea, he says, "I am legally responsible for his death." He didn't say, "I shot and killed Martin Luther King Jr."
That's a
point of interest.
That is an interesting way to say that.
And history says he confessed because of the guilty plea. So most people don't realize that most people around him claim he never actually said those words.
I'm having a hard time thinking, man, so I need your brain. What's it called when you're not really pleading guilty, but you realize that all the circumstances and evidence...
No contest.
Yeah. I feel like that could be what he's doing. The FBI argued that Ray's motive was that of greed. Ray, who was still on the run from the law for previous crimes, would kill King and then claim a number of bounties and cash rewards from various racist Southern groups. William Bradford Huey states in his book, which is called He Slew the Dreamer, that Ray was a racist and a hateful criminal who wanted to claim a bounty from members of the KKK to begin again.
All accounts, we don't know that he ended up getting a large payout. No cash was ever discovered or payout really traced back. Ray's first attorney was Art Haynes from Birmingham, Alabama, and his son, who was a very new attorney at the time, they believed, and the younger is still alive today, that the prosecution didn't even have a good case. They don't think that Ray's guilty, and they thought if they were able to take this to trial, they had a lot of confidence they could win. Due to some unknown and sketchy circumstances, Ray was put in contact with another attorney named Percy Foreman, who we're going to talk about quite a bit here. Now, we do know that Ray was a little bit unhappy with Haynes and his son because he wanted to take the stand, and they didn't want him to do that. They knew that defendants taking the stand was generally not a good idea. Some claim that he reached out to Foreman. Some claim that his brother did. Regardless, Percy Foreman came in and essentially took the case from Haynes. 3 days after this guilty plea and sentencing, Ray fired Percy Foreman, claiming that this guilty plea was the only way to escape the death penalty, which, I mean, honestly, if he's found guilty of this, pleading not guilty, it may have been. He was also threatened, allegedly, that they were going to put his brother in jail as well. Some people still speculate that his brother Jerry was involved. Ray would hire a new attorney, William Bill Pepper, and it took a while for Bill to take the case, but eventually he would argue that Ray had accidentally assisted in the murder of King, and he believed himself to be a victim of this conspiracy as well and to be used as a pawn, and said he did not know what was going to happen and did not knowingly contribute to this murder. They had no luck in trying to get this reopened for years. Obviously, if you're found guilty, there are all kinds of avenues for appeal, but if you plead guilty, that's even a little bit different. Finally, like I said earlier, the King family came around to believing that Ray was innocent, and that helped this to gain some traction. King's oldest son, Dexter, met with Ray in prison in 1997, and Dexter said this: "As awkward as it may seem, I want you to know that I believe you, and my family believes you, and we're going to do everything in our power to try and make sure that justice will prevail. And while it's at the 11th hour, I've always been a spiritual person, and I believe in providence." So they are saying, A, that they want justice to be served. I think they want justice for the death of their father, uncle, husband, grandfather. But they also believe that includes setting James Earl Ray free. But within a year, he died of complications in prison due to hepatitis. Some believe he got that infection from a prison fight. Some believe he had it before he went into prison. In 1999, Coretta King ended up suing a guy named Lloyd Jowers, who owned Jim's Grill, which was across the street from the Lorraine Motel, and the federal government for committing a conspiracy to commit murder on her husband. So this is a civil lawsuit. It's known as the King Family versus Lloyd Jowers and Other Unknown Conspirators. This went on for 2 weeks as Bill Pepper brought forward 70 witnesses and thousands of documents. Jowers testified that Ray was only a scapegoat and that the Memphis police officer Earl Clark actually fired the fatal shots. Again, Jowers owned and operated the grill across the street from the Lorraine Motel. Ultimately, the King family won. After an hour of deliberation, the jury found that King was assassinated as the result of a conspiracy. Though he was dead, the King family found vindication and aiding to reveal at least some semblance of the truth. But that was it. No further criminal cases were pursued. You have Jowers on the stand saying he knows who killed King and it wasn't Ray. And in the following years, a lot of the witness statements from the civil suits would start to be picked apart. Some of it was disproven, but basically all of this information was buried and unable to get to the surface again, especially since Ray was dead.
Can you talk to me like I'm five and explain to me what happened in the 1999 Coretta King sues Lloyd Jowers again in the federal government? Like, I feel like you said something really important. I just want to make sure I caught it.
Yeah, so she sued them in a civil suit, just like you look at the Goldman and Brown families for O.J. They sued O.J. in a civil suit for the wrongful death of Nicole Brown, Ronald Goldman, and they won. The level of proof required for a guilty verdict in civil court is much lower than a criminal court.
But what? So what was the verdict? Who was guilty of what? Yep.
The verdict was that Martin Luther King Jr. was killed as the result of a conspiracy of many parties and that it was not just James Earl Ray. But they didn't confirm a specific set of circumstances to say, we believe this thing happened and these people were involved. They just agreed that there was a cover-up of some kind by the government and that there was a bigger story there. So there wasn't a definite detail of what happened that came out of it, but it showed that there was enough evidence that something was going on.
So how is this not like bigger news?
Right.
Because basically a court has said, yes, it does appear as if there is a conspiracy and it was more than just James Earl Ray.
I don't know. How could the government not pick this up and run with it? Or how was there not enough outcry for the government to step or somebody to step in and say, we have to do something with this?
I want to look up the exact date and see what other big news broke that same time. You know what I mean?
Yep.
How did that not make bigger news?
Again, this was,
we were very much like teen.
I was in high school.
Yeah. We were in high schools. We would have been made aware of this.
Had no idea this happened until I became a podcaster. No clue.
So what's next? How can a story of such monumentous proportions have two entirely different sides? One of a simple, racially motivated shooting with a monster put behind bars, and the other, which was a web of intrigue that implicated almost all levels of the federal government. Many seem to believe that, like the King family, that there are just too many inconsistencies in the official reports from that day. So let's try to take a look at what those inconsistencies are. As the official story goes, they said that Ray fired his Remington 760 Game Master one time without ejecting the spent casing. So this is like a bolt action rifle. You do the action, and in order to fire another one, you have to release the bolt, put a new round in the chamber, and then push down the bolt. So he didn't do that. And he was said to have done all this from the window of a communal bathroom, which was across the street from King's Motel. He then walked down the hallway to a room that he had rented the night before, wrapped up his weapon and the additional belongings in a bed sheet, and then exited from the rear of that building. He would then go walking down the road in one direction. He would then abandon his bedsheet-wrapped equipment in front of another building before turning and running towards his vehicle, which was in the opposite direction. So, all right, some oddities, but nothing really damning until you arrive at the fact that the rifle which was found in the bedsheet was said to, man, there's so many things about this. So the weapon that state's witness directly tied back to Ray to carrying away from the scene was never ballistically matched to the bullet that actually killed King. Jamie, again, talk to me like I'm five. That means basically they have the bullet, they have the gun, but they weren't a match.
So ballistics with guns, the way they do it is they'll take a weapon they think may have been involved, find a round they believe to be the same as the one that was involved in the crime. They'll shoot it. And when you do so, there's a rifle twist that kind of etches into the round as it exits the weapon. So this was a 30 caliber, 30-06 round that had struck King, and it had a rifling twist of one turn every 11 and one quarter inches. Okay.
Right.
While the rifle found in the bedsheet only had a rifling twist of one turn every 10 inches.
So a skeptic in me would ask, okay, well, what could that change every time the bullet is fired through that gun? And an answer, I'm going to answer my own question, is no, because the gun has a set pattern of rifling that will never change. Right. It comes from the factory with that in the rifle.
Honestly, I think all ballistics like this are really sketchy. I think they can rule out weapons, but I don't know that they can exactly match a weapon. And there are times when if you don't clean your gun, it can alter it just a little bit by having too much material in there. And actually, most of this was brought to light by Judge Joe Brown. Do you remember that TV show?
This was like one of those Judge Judy shows, but the judge was Judge Joe Brown.
He was Joe Brown, and he was a real judge before he went on TV in Memphis and heard a lot of these pleas, and he's the one that raised all of this issue about the gun ballistics. He was an expert in this, and he was actually in charge of deciding whether or not this was enough to bring about a new appeal because he was out of appeals. Ultimately, it got shot down for some red tape. But this is it's fascinating. Judge Joe Brown was involved. But B, what they found, you can rule out weapons. And for the most part, I think they ruled this one out. So if the gun that they found was not the murder weapon, I mean, isn't that reasonable doubt? Because his fingerprints were on the gun they found for sure.
Well, I think we just need to keep that in the back of our mind as I go through some other oddities, all right? Additionally, the owner of the store, which the bag was dropped, or I say bag, but it was a bed sheet, right, was dropped at, would later go on to claim that he actually witnessed this thing be dropped calmly by a man several minutes before he heard the gunshot. So this is like the dropped gun, and then the gunshot, which means this is staged evidence.
Yeah, and he would go on to say up to 10 minutes before then. And the gun itself, we're going to get into this a little bit more in a minute, but James Earl Ray said he was working for this guy named Raul, which may or may not exist, may or may not be his real name, but he told Ray to go and buy a weapon. He went to a store, a gun store, and he bought a different rifle. He brought it back to Raul, and Raul said, no, this is the wrong one. Go and get a rifle that'll fire a 30 caliber round. So he went back and got a second rifle, and that was the one that his fingerprints were on and that was found. And they confirmed with the gun shop manager that he did come and exchange the gun. So the first gun could have killed somebody. There's no reason why he would have needed to change it, I don't think, except for the fact that maybe if somebody was trying to pin this on him, they needed a weapon that was similar to the murder weapon with his fingerprints on it.
Another thing that's interesting to me is that the state's witness who claimed to have seen Ray abandon his items was a drunk man who had been arrested in Memphis over 100 times, and he only came forward with this information after there was a $100,000 bounty placed that for anyone who could provide police information after the police had already announced Ray was the suspect. So it's like, hey, I'll just go corroborate this and get $100,000.
Low hanging fruit, easy money.
And he was also so drunk at the time of the shooting that a cab driver refused to pick him up. And that's according to Art Haynes. And when later shown an image of Ray, he claimed that that wasn't who he actually saw.
And that's the only witness that places
him doing the drop.
Him doing the drop.
That's insane to me.
Yeah, nobody else.
At least two different witnesses from inside the boarding house claimed that they thought the shot had come from outside and not the bathroom upstairs. One of them, alongside several passerbys on the street, claimed to see a man holding a rifle covered in a white sheet outside the boarding house, who then ducked into the bushes. So if that's true, then that means it was not fired from the bathroom window in the boarding house, correct?
Right. And there is evidence to say that it did come from that area of the bushes. There were people who we saw later, namely Lloyd Jowers, who ended up with mud on their pants that day as if they had been ducking down in the bushes. So certainly a lot of suspicion about where the shot came from and who was there, and really no strong witnesses or evidence to tie James Earl Ray to the actual gunshot. We're going to take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk about the official story and how that differs from what we think may have happened behind the scenes. So the official story gives us James Earl Ray, who had escaped from prison in a bread truck under some loaves of bread. And it paints him as a mastermind who got this weapon, killed this leader in order to, some say he wanted to start a race war and he wanted to be the one to start it. And that's why he left his fingerprints and left the weapon where people would find him. All these theories about why he did it. He was able to flee the country. But Ray claims he was working with this mysterious guy we referenced earlier named Raul, and that he was only acting at the time as a getaway driver for something that he was unaware of. Ray also claims that while he was running, he was being financed and guided by a handler working with Raul, just known as the Fat Man. If I ever become a mob boss, I think I want that to be my nickname. While it wouldn't be impossible for somebody to evade capture for as long as Ray did, it really wasn't that long. I mean, we think about Lee Harvey Oswald being arrested that day. We know the recent attempt on Donald Trump's life, the shooter was eliminated before he left the scene. But it's hard to believe that Ray, on his own, could plan all this out as perfectly as he had seemed to, but then be caught so easily. Even with his previous prison escape, a lot of that had to be luck. And some would say that he had help, maybe somebody wanting him out of prison, or maybe he just made friends with people working there. But it was not a mastermind escape plan either. We don't think of this guy as a huge criminal, of a kingpin of any kind. And as it turns out, Ray knew almost nothing about firearms. He had used weapons to hold up places, but never fired them, as far as we know. The gun store owner where he bought the Remington that they found said that when he came in, he had no clue what he was asking for, had no idea what he was talking about. And then when he came back, he just brought a catalog where Raul had circled the weapon he wanted him to buy. So it's corroborated that he didn't know a lot about guns. He was in the military for a little bit, but he ended up being discharged for failure to adapt to military life, and he scored really low on all of his marksmanship tests. So if Ray wasn't the one who took the shot, if he wasn't planning all this on his own or with his brothers or with Raul, then what do we think happened, and who was the guy in the bushes?
2 hours before the time of the shootings, there was a detective, Ed Reddit, who had been assigned to King's protection detail and had received word that there was a contract out for his life. To be clear, I'm not talking about Martin Luther King Jr.'s life. I'm talking about his own life. So while King was killed, this person who was on his detail, Reddit, was at home hiding, and he was being flanked by Secret Service in a form of protection. So the guy who's kind of in charge of protecting King is at home not being protected himself, because there's a contract out for his life, allegedly.
Yeah, that's really hard to believe, but he wasn't there. So there's evidence to support that he for whatever reason, bowed out of his duties.
Well, and I mean, is it say he was an FBI agent? It wasn't like he was just some random bodyguard, right? Later reports would show that the FBI believed that the information that there was actually a threat on Reddit's life was simply a mistake. So maybe there was, maybe there wasn't, but the FBI acted as if there was at the time. If the government was involved in the assassination, it's unlikely that they had one of their own people in the field doing the dirty work. So they would have to get somebody to be their fall guy. And there are several people that you could choose from. First, Lloyd Jowers. We've heard this name before, right?
Right.
He's the bar and grill owner that there's the restaurant directly under the boarding house, which is the area where the shot came from. So the day after the shooting, a cab driver who frequented that establishment claimed that Jowers took him behind the counter to show him a .30-06 rifle.
Yeah, and Betty Spates, who was Jowers was a white guy. Betty Spates was a young black woman that worked for him. They had a relationship outside of work, a sexual relationship. And she claimed in years later and told Bill Pepper that on the day of the shooting, she heard a popping sound outside and she saw Jowers come in the door holding a rifle that was literally smoking, and he broke it down and hid it in the kitchen. Now, whether he made the shot, whether he was handed the weapon, he's told several different stories, but it seems that very possible that he did come in with a rifle. So there is something to his involvement, although that goes up and down depending on which theory you believe.
So investigators followed up on this report, and they would actually interview a waitress who claimed that on the day of the shooting, she heard a gunshot just before Jowers re-entered the diner from the rear door, holding the rifle that was usually behind the counter, and his pants were covered in mud, which would mean he was outside, like in a grassy or muddy area.
In the bushes.
With a gun.
Maybe.
Yeah, and the gun had been fired. So then there's Willie Atkins, who is a business partner of Jowers. And Willie Atkins said that Jowers had actually confided to him years after this potential involvement in the shooting, so that like Jowers' job was not to necessarily kill Martin Luther King, but to dispose of the weapon. Correct?
Right. He confessed that he was involved, but his job was just to get rid of the gun.
So Jowers was a former member of the Memphis Police Department, and he told Atkins that he thought he was chosen for the job because of that connection and because of how close his business was to King's most frequented motel. In 1993, Jowers appeared on ABC News program Primetime Live, and he claimed that he was paid $100,000 by an alleged local mobster, Frank Liberto, to help organize King's assassination.
Liberto had a very vocal hatred of Martin Luther King Jr. He was very connected. There were a lot of people that claimed that he was involved in the Dixie Mafia, and that the Memphis area was really a place where that presence was felt. And Liberto supposedly answered the phone and said, "I told you not to call me here. Shoot the son of a bitch when he comes on the balcony." And somebody overheard that phone conversation. So the involvement of the Dixie Mafia is highly suspected by most. And Liberto is one of those involved. And of course, it's Jowers who says that they got him involved to actually pull the trigger or to hide the weapon, depending on who you talk to. And other members and former members of the Dixie Mafia have come forward and said that they had a close relationship with the FBI, specifically Hoover and his associate Clyde Tolson, and that they worked with them to get this done because they trusted the Dixie Mafia could take care of it. Going back to Percy Foreman, who was the attorney that came in and kind of stole the case, he talked James Earl Ray into pleading guilty. And as it turns out, Foreman would later be identified as an associate of Liberto and has some ties to the mafia. A year after this happened, after Earl pled guilty and was in prison, it came out that Percy Foreman had been involved in another case in Texas where he actually went into a case. He got a client and who was in trouble with the mafia, had the mafia pay him to get the client to plead guilty and keep his mouth shut so that the mafia wouldn't kill him and that he wouldn't out the mafia. So he went and played a middleman and got rich off of making somebody plead guilty for a crime they didn't commit, which, looking back, it sounds a lot like what may have happened here. And we saw that he pushed himself into this case. So not a good look for Foreman and his role in this entire case. Jowers, when asked, claimed the actual shooter, like John said earlier, was Memphis Police Department Lieutenant Earl Clark. He did claim it was a few other people over the course of time. There was one guy named Frank Holt, who they were able to track down and prove he wasn't there, and then he moved on to Clark. What we do know is that Clark was the most accomplished marksman in the Memphis Police Department, for whatever that's worth, and it said that he also had an association with Liberto and the Mafia. A janitor who worked at the department claimed that the night before the shooting, the police chief held a meeting in his office with Clark, some other high-ranking officials within the police department, including Lieutenant Strasser, who spent the entire day drilling with his own .30-06 rifle. By drilling, I mean going Practicing. Through shooting drills. Yeah. With all this in mind, some theorists believe that the mafia got involved, that they got Clark and Strasser involved in the shooting. Maybe Strasser was a backup shooter. Maybe Clark was. And then they got with Jowers to dispose the weapon, and they planted the other weapon in the nearby alley in front of that store. So, and that they probably took the real weapon and threw it off a bridge. So that is one theory of if it was the mafia in charge of this, how they used local police and business owners to get it done.
Well, they arrested James Earl Ray. So let's talk a little bit more about a possible conspiracy that involves him. So after World War II, Ray worked for the OSS, which was an organization that would go on to become the CIA. When his family asked him about like what he did for a job, he had a hard time describing to them what he actually did. And he basically described an organization that was likened to the mafia. So some conspiracy theorists go as far to connect Ray and his time with the CIA to the early days of the MK Ultra program, which we have discussed on this show.
Yeah, basically giving guys acid to see if you can get secrets out of them or hide secrets with drugs.
More commonly believed than that connection is that Ray was actually a government asset that the CIA held until they needed him for a particular reason. Ray had attempted to escape prison many times, but would only ever be punished by being administered new medicines. After his successful escape from the Jefferson City prison, his cellmate, who pushed him to try to escape in the first place, was found hanging in a cell with all of his limbs broken. Are you familiar with this case?
I'm not.
To talk about that?
There's not a lot out there about this particular situation, but I do think it's really hard to hang yourself if all your limbs are broken.
That's, you know, a very fair point.
Yep.
I want to talk about this man named Raoul, all right? Ray first met this guy shortly after escaping from jail, and Raoul treated James Earl Ray very well. He was able to fund his new life. He gifted Ray fake IDs and passports and enough money to buy himself a brand new car, which was actually a white Ford Mustang. Ray claims that Raoul made all of his money as a gun runner for a fraction of the Cuban militants that were hiding within the United States and looking to keep the money going. And so Ray and Raoul became like business partners. So one day, according to James Earl Ray, Raoul claimed that they were going to need around 200 rifles to sell to a specific group of this militant fraction. All Raoul needed James Earl Ray to do was to go down to Alabama and buy a single rifle to show the group as a preview of the batch that was to come. So Ray was instructed to purchase a Remington 760 Game Master chambered in a .30-06, which we all know was the one previously mentioned that was identified as the murder weapon that killed Martin Luther King Jr. So the day before the assassination, James Earl Ray claims that Raoul met him at the diner, which was below the boarding house, and said that they needed to meet with the Cubans tomorrow, so he needed James to rent a room upstairs for the deal to take place in. Raul would handle the Cubans, and all James Earl Ray needed to do was wait outside, and if things went bad, he was to act as the getaway driver. And that's what James Earl Ray claims he did. He said that when all this happened, he got in his Mustang outside, and when he heard the shot ring out, Raul was able to get in the back seat and they drove off. Thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's also a story that's hard to believe. This Raul, they were able to track down a Raul, but not sure if it's the same guy. And there's no paper trail of how James Earl Ray worked with Raul. He wasn't able to give an address or even a phone number. So Raul being involved in leaping in the car also kind of flies in the face of the other theories that the police were involved, the mafia was involved. Why was Raul jumping in the car if he wasn't the shooter? Obviously, Raul could have been a fake name. Maybe it was Earl Clark. Who knows? But it's a sketchy story for sure, and honestly, pretty hard to believe.
Well, I mean, he jumped in the car, but allegedly, according to James Earl Ray, when they got outside of town to the border, Raul jumped out of the car and was never seen again. Jumped in, jumped out.
And never heard from again.
Ray says that he kept running until he arrived in Atlanta before the handler known as Fat Man, which is like a great mafia name, gave him his new IDs and enough money to go on the run. And he says that he only learned when leaving Atlanta from the radio that he had probably taken a part in the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. Ray's story, while it is only his own story, would be corroborated by Daniel Ellsberg, the man who leaked the Pentagon Papers, swore in an affidavit that Agent Brady Tyson told him that it was J. Edgar Hoover who had Martin King Jr. killed. Hoover, who was the director of the FBI, instructed his right-hand man, Clyde Tolson, to organize a mob hit on King the next time he was to be in Memphis.
So one of my main sources of research that has the most fascinating interviews is a podcast called the MLK Tapes. And in this podcast, they interview a member of the mafia who says that he knew Clyde Tolson so well that he was like Uncle Clyde when he came to visit to do these deals with the mafia. So he insists that they were very in the thick of it with Hoover, Tolson, and the FBI. And the FBI really had problems with King's ideals and movements throughout. One thing that came up is that he often spoke out against the war in Vietnam, which was a really big deal. It was a really touchy subject, but with his platform to speak out against the war was something that the government had as big a problem with as the other things he was doing, probably. And the FBI had previously tried to harass him into submission. Supposedly, the FBI even planted an agent named Merrill McCullough in King's inner circle. And I don't know if McCullough was involved or not. We do know that they were bugging Martin Luther King Jr.'s hotel rooms and potentially his phones. They had some recordings, some of infidelity, of him cheating on his wife, allegedly. One of the tapes was sent to him along with an anonymous letter. Now, the last paragraph of this letter said, "King, there's only one thing left for you to do. You know what it is. You have just 34 days in which to do this, and this exact number has been selected for a specific reason. It has definite practical significance. You are done. There is but one way out for you. You better take it before your filthy, abnormal, fraudulent self is bared to the nation." So basically, King's belief is that this letter was encouraging him to kill himself. Some believe that somebody's advocating for him to decline the Nobel Peace Prize, and the timeline with the 34 days kind of goes along with that. But here's the thing, John. It was later confirmed by a leak of classified documents from the FBI that this letter was written by somebody in the FBI office. They sent a letter, essentially an audio sex tape, to tell King, in his interpretation, kill yourself or we're going to let everybody hear you cheating on your wife.
It's wild, man.
The FBI did that. Like, it's not a theory there. So we know that they were out for him. Jowers would claim that the day before, a meeting was held at his diner with those who were taking part in the assassination. He would claim that five people were there in total. He could only identify Earl Clark, but another one of those attendants was supposedly McCullough, who again may have been placed by the FBI to be in King's inner circle. After the first march in Memphis, King decided it was too dangerous to go back and stay at the Lorraine Motel in room 306, and he actually tried to have his room changed for the next visit because he was very exposed coming out of that room. It was on the second floor. But somebody who claimed to be with King called ahead and requested going back to room 306. That could have been McCullough. It could have been somebody else. It could have been James Earl Ray if he's the one that did it. But when they arrived at the hotel, it was too late to change it, so he had to stay in room 306, and he was coming out of that room when he was shot. The FBI, as soon as they got on the scene, took over the investigation, which I think they probably had to. This was a big national story. There's a reason we call it an assassination instead of just a murder, right? Another of other suspicious, odd circumstances popped up throughout the investigation and throughout the civil trial. The day of the assassination, while police were investigating the boarding house, Captain Ed Atkinson overheard Clark mention to another officer that they would have to trim the branches on the tree outside. So, John, after the murder, what good is trimming those trees going to do? It seems unrelated, and in some ways seems like you're getting rid of something at the scene, tampering with the scene. I don't know. What are they doing here?
Well, I mean, first off, why is that a priority at this time? You know, I know that hotel owners or whatever, you know, they're not directly impacted by this, but it would be like me on 9/11 saying, you know what? I really need to start landscaping.
Yep.
Like, no, my mind was preoccupied that day. And even though I didn't have any family at the scene or any real ties, like, that's a major event in America. I went to football practice, but we even took time to like say, this is not a normal day.
Right.
Anyway, my theory is the bathroom where this was allegedly happening from had a tree obstructing the view. And would there have really been able to be that accurate of a shot from that place with an obstructed view? So I don't know. It almost seems like they realized that after the fact and they were like, hey, this tree needs to go.
Right.
Is that ridiculous?
No, I think that's the speculation there is in order to make their story work or make the cover-up story work, they needed rid of the bushes.
And they needed the bushes gone too. I mean, they said, you know, somebody said they actually saw someone retreat to the bushes. Well, now there's no bushes, so it's going to be impossible to reconstruct that.
Absolutely. A nurse at St. Joseph Hospital, which was where Martin Luther King was rushed, claimed that while King still had a pulse, a number of men in suits ordered all but the doctor who called King's time of death out of the room. So they wanted everybody gone, nobody in there inspecting the body or trying to do other life-saving efforts. A cab driver named Buddy, great cab driver name, who claimed to have seen a shooter running from the bushes and into a getaway car, was killed when he jumped out of his own moving vehicle into oncoming traffic, which, again, is possible. Just another suspicious circumstance here. One of Ray's lawyers ended up committing suicide while trying to help him some appeals. Two separate judges were considering giving Ray a retrial, and both died of a heart attack. And actually, one of them was just days after he had pled guilty. He filed a form to recant his plea and to actually change it to not guilty. And the judge was found at his desk, dead, leaning over the paperwork that he was considering to give Ray a retrial. A year after the assassination, we mentioned earlier, Martin Luther King's brother Alfred was found floating dead in a pool. Story says he drowned, but he was only wearing his underpants and his neck was covered in bruises and there was no water in his lungs, which, as we've covered on many cases, sounds like it wasn't a drowning.
Can't drown if there's no water in your lungs.
Yep.
So if you think back to what we started talking about at the beginning of this episode, Martin Luther King Jr.'s wife won a lawsuit, a civil lawsuit, where it was the verdict that, you know what, there is enough reason to believe that James Earl Ray was not a lone shooter and there was some kind of conspiracy, but they were not able to nail or iron all of that out. So all of this information combined was what basically led the Shelby County jury to reach that unanimous verdict that King's assassination was the result of a conspiracy. They believed that Jowers was responsible and that several government agencies would have had to be a part of this conspiracy. And so while we just covered a whole lot of possibilities, I think it was probably a lot of those combined to make this whole thing work. And I'm not at a point where I can really say exactly how I think it went down, but I think there was a lot of moving parts with a lot of agencies involved, ultimately all going back to what is now the CIA.
Yeah, we really don't have anything that's come out since 1999. There was a House Select Committee on Assassinations that put out a report, but kind of like the JFK report, was also inconclusive. In 1993, they actually held a mock trial on HBO where Bill Pepper was Ray's defense attorney. They ran it just like a real trial. And in that trial, allegedly it was all straight up. It wasn't skewed either way. He was acquitted due to lack of evidence.
Unless there's a new report or some kind of an admittance of guilt, there's really no way to discover anything else about Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination today. There are no more witnesses left to question. There are no more firsthand accounts to ever be seen. So I think it kind of is what it is. And I don't think the government would ever kind of keep documents that would, you know, point fingers on themselves. So we're never going to know what happened to MLK.
Yeah. And we know that there are some JFK documents that are left out there that we may never see, but as far as we know, there's nothing left out there, at least documented, about this assassination. I like talking about conspiracies. I love speculating about the CIA putting together Lee Harvey Oswald and sending him to Russia and sending him to Mexico and them being behind the whole thing. More likely than not, it was just him. But in this situation, the lack of physical evidence putting James Earl Ray there, all the other circumstances with the mafia, with Jowers, with local police, with the FBI spying on him, I have to believe there is more to this one. So if we're putting these on a scale, I think it's much more likely there was a conspiracy to kill King than there was to kill JFK.
And I don't disagree with you, but I'm trying to wrap my mind around why. How could eliminating Martin Luther King Jr. benefit the United States government?
Well,
was it just so that he was the one kind of organizing some of the marches, and politically it just needed to stop for some of these folks? I mean, how did it benefit?
Yeah, I think he was leading a movement which ultimately led to the passage of several laws that changed the way of life existed in our country. He was speaking out against the war that the government was trying to get support for. So I think they were afraid of the momentum and power he was gaining and the way he was changing our country. And just a lot of people wanted to keep things the way they were.
He served as the leader of the movement that could disrupt the old school way of doing things.
Yeah.
And so we don't, I mean, I'm saying we as if I'm the government, but I feel like it's them saying, you know what, we're happy the way things are. We don't need to change. And if this guy's the problem, let's just take out the problem.
And he was the leader, the face of that movement, and continues to be so. And I think at the time, he was a lot more controversial. I think now very few people look back on him and his work poorly. Hopefully very few people do. But just want to take another second of knowledge. We're two white dudes talking about this. We understand the weight of what happened during the civil rights movement, but we can't readily identify with what that was like. But I do think that that's exactly why specifically the government, FBI, CIA possibly, wanted rid of him. And this is how they got rid of them. You need more evidence? Jowers went and bought a cab company after this happened. He didn't have any money, but he had some cash after.
Yeah. I don't think that's a coinky dink.
Follow the money. See where it leads.
I really don't want to live in a country where my own government could potentially be taking people out. And I don't think that this is just limited to Martin Luther King Jr. I think the government has ways of taking out several other people. Did it take out Robert Kennedy? Did it take out John F. Kennedy? I think these are big questions that we probably need to tackle and address and get the answers to, and then say, you know what? We're not good with this anymore.
The people with the power to address them are the people doing it. I think it's kind of the problem. And I want to end on this quote. This is from King's friend, James Bevel. And he says, and this is kind of the final note that I agree with. There's no way a 10-cent white boy could develop a plan to kill a $1 million black man. That sounds like it sums everything up, or at least my opinion of what happened here very nicely. We would love to know what you think. Maybe you have other theories. Maybe you're from Memphis and you know a guy. We would love to hear what you think and your opinions of this case. And then other cases like this you want us to cover. We're unfortunately have no shortage of cases, but we want to talk about things people want to hear about. So that's what I got for today. If I'm going to wear a conspiracy hat, this is the case I'm wearing it for.
Yeah, absolutely. Guys, we appreciate everything that you do for us. Take a moment and leave us a rating and a review. 5-star would be incredible, but we'll take what you have. And if you have a case suggestion, that would be a great way to get that in our ears.
Yep, we would love to hear from you. Feel free to email us at truecrimecast@gmail.com. Follow us on TikTok and Instagram as well. We're really active over there.
Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.